Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I spoke once before to the organization. That was in summer of 2002. Who was there that night? Anybody remember? A few of you? Okay. I hope that we don't wait another 8 years to bring me back, okay? Despite the difficulties, I've had a good time so far, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the week here. And tonight I'm going to speak on something very different from 8 years ago. I'm going to be speaking out creation and cosmology. And a large part of this is based upon a book I had published a few years ago. The book is called Universe by Design. And as he mentioned, we have it in the place back there, the book table. I think they have about a dozen copies. The SRP on that is $14, but I checked, they have it on sale for $13 tonight. So it's a good deal. You might beat that price on the internet, but then you have to pay shipping. So that works out just as well. And if you want me to, if you buy one tonight, I'll be happy to sign it for you, too. Again, a lot of the things I talk about tonight, not everything, but a lot of things I talk about will be in the book, plus a lot more. So if it whets your appetite and you want to learn more about it, I recommend the book, of course, but I am a little biased on that front. I do take a historical development to cosmology. I like history a lot, so that I can combine three passions, history and astronomy and creation. That's really just almost a perfect thing to talk about. And I want to start off tonight by pointing out that evolution is not a new idea. It's been around a very long time. Many times people think that Darwin invented evolution, and that's not true. The ancients believed in evolution. Their gods really weren't capable of fiat creation. They're just kind of supermen, and they believed that things evolved. Darwin ended up doing was giving us the modern theory of biological evolution. But I think this seed of evolutionary thinking has been around from ancient times. And unfortunately, in the Christian era, people brought in a lot of Greek ideas. Augustine did it 15 centuries ago with Plato. And then in the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas brought it in with Aristotle. And when they brought these ideas in, they brought in a lot of pagan foundations as well. It's kind of an odd wedding of Christian, biblical, and then pagan ideas. I think it would have been much better served had some people in the past sat down and kind of started from scratch. I do believe there's a lot of biblical thinking underlying original intent of science, but there's also some other sloppy things creeping in. We've been paying a price on all of this. And evolutionary thinking has really permeated all of human endeavor. There's evolutionary theory of biology and geology, cosmology, stars, planets, also even human endeavor, history and law, marriage, those kind of things all have evolutionary theories about those. The wrong theory, of course. We have a creationary or biblical-based theory for all of these, too. And one thing about astronomy, it's a very old science. It was the oldest science, I think, because it had to be useful for calendar development. One of the most important things in an agrarian society is to know when to plant. You know, you get a few warm days back where I'm from, it starts getting warm in March and early April, and you're really supposed to wait until late April to put those plants in. And back about 2 years ago, I went out to the garden store in early April, and I bought some plants and brought them out home and put them out. I told the guy on the television news weather report, said, don't do that, but I didn't listen. And sure enough, the middle of the month, we had a low in Fahrenheit. I'm still thinking Fahrenheit, 15 degrees. And I live near Charlotte, North Carolina, and they recorded the lowest temperature ever in any month of April. You know, so much for global warming. And I went out and I tried to cover all those little bitty plants up, but I still lost most of them. It just really was really rough. And how did they know not to plant quite that early? Wait until late April? Well, because people have been keeping calendars, been keeping records, and you don't just go out and plant when it feels good and feels warm. You really need to look at the long-term there. So calendar development's key for an agrarian society, which people were throughout much of history. Also, you look at the purposes from the day four narrative. And over dinner, we had some people kind of stumped on this about some of the things that they created light bearers on day four were to do. And they were to provide for light on the earth, divide the night from the day, and to rule over the day, rule over the night, and be for marking times and seasons and for signs. So they all have purposes going way back. And there's a rich pagan history. For instance, our planets are named after pagan gods. There are five naked-eye planets: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Those are Roman names for the gods. The Greeks had their equivalents: Aphrodite, Ares, Zeus, and so forth. There's a rich pagan history there. And the sun and the moon, those are gods and names of gods. Saul is a name of a god. It's interesting that in the creation account, the Lord doesn't even use the names. He simply says he made the greater light and the lesser light. And I love that, because it's not even mentioning the names of those pagan deities that they have in the Middle East. We also have constellations and star names with a lot of mythology and pagan ideas. There's a lot of that wrapped up in there. And there's a religion based on all of this. What's it called? Astrology, the belief that the heavenly bodies somehow affect our destinies and our lives. I don't know how many times I've been accused of being an astrologer. People, very educated people, don't know any difference. They think they call it astrology. I've had at least one student sign up for my class thinking that they were going to do horoscopes. What a rude awakening that student had. So I think most of them are just a little too embarrassed to admit that. So one of the first things I do the first day of class is make sure you're in the right classroom, find out what class you're actually in. But then cosmology is a study of the structure of the universe. We think today of cosmology, the big scale of things, of galaxies and quasars and expansion of the universe. But there are many other types of cosmologies. The idea that the Earth is the center of things, the geocentric theory, that's a cosmology. The heliocentric theory, that the Earth is just one of several planets orbiting around the sun, that's the heliocentric theory as opposed to the geocentric theory. And the way the galaxy is put together, we had what's called the grindstone model from 200 years ago from Sir William Herschel. That was a cosmology. Any statement about some aspect or structure of the universe, or some portion of the universe, that is a type of cosmology. And one of the first successful cosmologies was put together by a fellow named, or at least codified, by a guy named Claudius Ptolemy. He lived early in the 2nd century AD. He was Greek. Judging by the name, I think you'll conclude that. He lived in Alexandria, the greatest city of learning at that time, and had been for centuries. And he put together this 13-volume compendium of all ancient astronomy. Almost everything we know about ancient Middle Eastern and European astronomy comes via his book that he wrote. And he also put together in that book a model to describe the motions of the planets. Now, this is very important because the sun and the moon and the five naked-eye planets, for a total of seven objects, were the objects that people thought affected our destinies, dealing with astrology. In order for astrology to be practiced, you needed to know where things were in the past and where they would be in the future. You want to get a horoscope done, you tell the astrologer where you were born and when you were born, and he then figures out where everything was, and then he wants to compute your destiny starting perhaps right now based upon all of that. Well, you have to know where these things are. And the sun follows a fairly regular pattern. It's a little irregular, but fairly regular. The moon, a little less so. It goes around us once a month, and the sun appears to go around us once a year due to our revolution around the sun. But then the five naked-eyed planets went through a very odd motion. Normally, what they did is they moved west to east through the stars. So, sort of like this. See, west and east. Yeah, through the sky, west is to your right and east is to your left. So the planets would tend to do this, moving this way with respect to, say, these stands here, our background stars. A planet like Mars would tend to creep along in a west to east motion like this. But then periodically, it would stop and then move this direction and then stop and move forward again. So I'll redo that motion. This is the kind of motion over several months that a planet would follow. It would go like this and then like that. And then later on, it would go on around this Earth like this, and it would do it again in another place over there and another place. Very complex motion. And people back then, 2,000 years ago, were trying to describe this motion, and they had to do it with circles because they thought things in the heavens were perfect. And what was more perfect? See, things on the earth were imperfect. What's more perfect than a circle? And they had to move uniformly around those circles, because what's more perfect than a uniform circle? So uniform motion along that circle. So they had to cut a straitjacket on how, what kind of motions they would have. Well, this guy, Ptolemy, came up with a system using what we know as epicycles. And so let's try this. We have motion of the planets. And this theory of epicycle motion, what you would have is you'd have a planet moving on a circle like this. This is the epicycle. The planet's here moving on this circle called the epicycle. And then the epicycle would move forward like this, or in a circle around the Earth. So when you combine the two motions, you would end up with a motion like that. Okay, or to use my body again, it would be a motion like this. Now, it looks kind of weird. I hear people chuckling, and it looks kind of complicated, but all it is just two little gears running, a smaller gear running kind of fast, and a bigger gear running a little slower, and you end up with this very complex looping motion. But if you adjust the sizes of the two circles, the epicycle and the much larger circle being the deferent, adjust the sizes of those two circles and the rate at which they turn, you can mimic the motions of those planets pretty well. That was a pretty good breakthrough. I think the next slide. Oh, by the way, this theory ran from the 2nd century up through the 17th century. 1,500 years. Is there any theory in all of science that's lasted that long? That's a long time. I would submit to you that the Ptolemaic model is the most successful theory of all time. It lasted 15 centuries. There's not a physical theory today that's more than about 300 years old. Newtonian physics, modern physics, quantum mechanics, and general relativity are less than a century old. And I think we're going to replace those eventually. So history keeps moving on. This thing was a long-term one. And so it's the best theory in terms of longevity of any theory at all times. I think the next slide illustrates how this happens. Watch carefully there. You can see Mars there is going a little circle. And you can see the path. Back it up and do that. Go back and go forward again. There you go. Very good. I'll do it several. Okay, yeah. It may just do it automatically. Let's see what it does. So you got the Earth there at the center, and Mars is moving on a little red epicycle, and the epicycle is moving on the green deferent, and it's got a little line there running from the Earth through Mars off in that little blue loop over there. You've got five stars lined up, and as Mars goes on that epicycle on the inside right there, it seems to move backwards, doesn't it? Do y'all see what's going on? Okay. And it's a kind of a loopy motion, as you might imagine, but it works if you adjust this. Now, you had to add a few more adjustments. For one thing, the orbits of the planets and the Earth are not quite in the same plane. They're inclined a little bit. So what happens, depending on where it is near the intersection points, the motion can actually be an S going one way or the other way, or it can be a loop opening upward or opening downward. So the way you fix that is you put another epicycle going the other direction. So while the planet's doing this, you got another epicycle going this direction. So already for five naked eye planets, that's 10 epicycles. And you had a couple each for the sun and the moon, because their motion actually is a little inhomogeneous. And as you went through the Middle Ages, they found slight discrepancies. We now had a baseline going on for many hundreds of years, and they found slight discrepancies between where a planet actually was and what the Ptolemaic model said, Ptolemaic model said it ought to be. So how did you fix that discrepancy? You threw in another epicycle. And by the time you get to the late Middle Ages, there were some systems that had like 60 and 70 epicycles in this whole thing. It got very complex. There was a Spanish prince by the name of Alfonso in the 15th century, 14th century, 15th century, who was being tutored on the Ptolemaic model, and he was said to have noted that had he been present at the creation, he could have given the creator a few suggestions. So it was a very complex system, and I think, you know, most of you realize what a problem this is. Let's go on to the next slide. And they eventually rejected that model. They rejected it because of the complexity of the model. That's the important thing. They rejected it because of the complexity of the model. And here's one more other point, and I want you to keep this in mind. If you have a theory like this that can be fixed with duct tape, chewing gum, and baling wire indefinitely, then how good is that model? It can't be falsified, can it?
And even in theory, you can't fault it. You can keep fixing it until you get it right. And that's not a very good theory. Oh, you see, a theory that cannot be disproven, even in hypothetical, isn't a very good theory, because it can explain anything and everything. And you ought to at least be able to stump a theory at some point. Do you all know who this is? Photograph that person. Okay, Edwin Hubble. Very good. He was an important American astronomer in the early part of the 20th century. He died in the 1950s. And he had three great contributions to modern astronomy and cosmology. In 1924, he showed that other galaxies exist. He used this telescope you see photographed right here, that's at the eyepiece of the thing, to do this, the Hooker telescope. He also, in 1928, followed that up with the idea that the universe is expanding, that the galaxies that he proved existed were getting farther and farther away. See, up to this time, there's a big debate whether there were other galaxies. They thought the Milky Way was it. They called it the galaxy, the Milky Way, the universe. And for about 45 years prior to 1924, they thought we were the only thing out there. But in 1924, he showed that other galaxies similar to our own exist. And overnight, the universe got a lot bigger. Well, he used the 100-inch telescope, as you see photographed here. It's in Southern California, San Gabriel Mountains, overlooking the Los Angeles Basin. More great discoveries were made with this telescope than any other, save the one that Galileo first used 400 years ago. It's a very significant telescope. And from 1917 or thereabouts until 1949, it was the largest telescope in the world. And it was supplanted by the 200-inch. But this is the famous 100-inch telescope. Great discoveries there. Here's a photograph. I started with this one. This is the Andromeda Galaxy. This is the one where he showed in 1924 that there were other galaxies. We think this galaxy is very similar to our own. At the center of the galaxy, you've got this bulge of stars. It's round and flat, probably about 100,000 light years across. That's probably about 10,000 light years thick at the center, and it kind of thins out as you go out. It's round and flat. It kind of has an appearance over an easy egg. That's the best way to describe that. And then in the disk of the galaxy, you have spiral arms, which, that's a whole can of worms to talk about in itself, so I'll just kind of let that go right now. There are also two little satellite galaxies, one to the left of the center and one to the lower right. Those are, we think, orbiting around the center of the Andromeda Galaxy. If this were our own galaxy, looking at it from some distance, we think it would look like this, and we would be about halfway out from the center towards the edge. So we're not in any particular notable location. For a long time, people thought we were at the center, but that was shown not to be the case about 90 years ago. And that Andromeda Galaxy is about 2 million light years away from us. It's the most distant object that one can see with the unaided eye on a normal basis. I've seen it many times. You just need to look for it in the fall. With dark sky, you need to know where to look. A little faint smudge to the eye. This is another spiral galaxy similar to the Milky Way. I love this one. It's called the Sombrero Galaxy, sometimes called M104. It's very similar to our own galaxy again, except it's more edge-on. And there's a big black dust lane running across there. We find dust is a common thing inside the disks of spiral galaxies. The next slide shows a barred spiral. I think these are very pretty. I don't do galaxies professionally. I do stars, but I've always thought barred spiral galaxies are particularly pretty galaxies. Notice the spiral arms come off the end of the bar. And we can't see to the center of our own galaxy because of the obscuration of the dust. We can't do that optically. We can pick up other wavelengths, such as in radio waves and so forth. And there's been a suggestion made since at least the 1970s that maybe there is a bar at the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. In the last 10 or 15 years, they've pretty well settled upon that. We can't see it directly, but there's good evidence coming from other wavelengths that there probably is a bar running across the center. Now, I don't know about you, but I feel better about myself already knowing that I live in a particularly beautiful galaxy. So it gives me a lot of self-worth and self-esteem to note that fact. This is a reproduction of the paper photograph or illustration from the 1928 paper that Edwin Hubble published. What he did is he took measurements of redshifts, how fast galaxies appear to be moving away from us. That's plotted vertically. So you have zero there, and then 500 kilometers per second, 1,000 kilometers per second. You see the velocity there written on the left. And then he plotted that versus that, measurements of distances. And we, in the last 80 years, that we've developed a much better techniques for finding distances. His distance methods were very crude. Sometimes I think ours are crude. They're just not as crude as his were. We're getting better at it. And what he did is he plotted the two of them. And you'll notice that as the distance increases, the velocity increases. So there are a couple of lines you can draw through that. And you can see that they're running diagonally. Y'all see that? That's showing that relationship. And that's what you would expect to see if the universe is expanding. Now, an example we can use is a race, like a 5 or 10K race. It's a bad example, but it's useful. Let's suppose there's a starting line over here where you're going to start the race, and the finish line is, say, over there. And you start the race. It's 5 kilometers. I've kind of made it a little smaller here for illustration purposes. And after the 5K race, you get about 15 minutes into the race, and there's some people over here, aren't there? And there's some people over here, and there's some people. They're all stretched out, aren't they? And if you measure their distance from you, from the origin, where the race started, you'll see a range of distances these runners have gotten. And what's the reason why some are far away and some are pretty close to the starting line? Their average speed, right? The fastest runners have gotten farther away, haven't they? In fact, if you plotted them, what you would find is a plot that looks quite a bit like that, wouldn't you? The faster they're running, the farther they've gotten away, haven't they? So that's what you would expect from an expanding universe, which, by the way, was something he expected from general relativity that had been devised by Albert Einstein about a decade before that. And another story there, how that came about, I don't have time to talk about it. Okay, anybody know who this is? John Bile can't answer, by the way. He knows who it is, I'm sure. Anybody else know who it is? Okay, his name is Georges Lemaître, all right? He was anybody heard that name before? He was a Belgian priest. Now, most people think of a priest, well, they do confessions and do mass and so forth, and many of them do, but you know what? You have to have faculty at all those Catholic universities. He was a theoretical physicist, had a PhD from MIT. There are a lot of the Vatican has an observatory. I've actually talked and I had a priest spend half a night just observing us at we were getting going off this telescope in a couple of nights. He was coming on. He just wanted to see how the system worked. It's kind of odd having a priest there with you, but he was one of the astronomers, PhD of astronomer. He was a priest. So there are a lot of scientists who are priests, and he was a theoretical physicist, and he developed. Back early in the century, about the time of Hubble's great work there, this theory he called the primeval atom or the cosmic egg. And his idea was that the universe is expanding, and the reason why it was expanding is because God created this primeval atom or cosmic egg of all the matter in the universe, really high density, really tiny, and then this thing kind of hatched or flew out like this, and we're now looking at the universe billions of years later. What do we call this model today? Not the primeval atom or the cosmic egg, but the Big Bang. That name came later, probably in the 1950s. But this was the precursor to that model, and by today's standards, a pretty naive model. But we give credit to Lemaître in the 1920s as being the fellow who actually started this. So the Big Bang model has been cleaned up. The modern version was first put forth in 1948 primarily by George Gamow and a student, Ralph Alper, on this. But the thing's been cleaned up over the years. And this idea is that dominant cosmology has been for the past 40-some years. And it's this belief that the universe started off as an ultra-dense, ultra-hot state, and that the universe began to expand very rapidly from that initial state, that event where it started, and we call the Big Bang. And it really met a lot of early rejection. The reason being is that the universe had a beginning. Now, for Georges Lemaître, that was great because he saw the hand of God. God made this thing to happen. But you see, running throughout all this Western thought, going back to the ancient Greeks, they didn't believe that the universe had a beginning. They believed that the universe was eternal. Remember, they were evolutionists. And what they thought was the universe had to always exist because, remember, their gods were not transcendent. They weren't capable of creating things ex nihilo. They were not much more than supermen. By the way, they were born and they eventually could die as well. So they weren't very powerful. They were kind of wimpy gods. And so they couldn't see how their gods could make the world. They also couldn't see how the world could come into existence on its own. So they just simply hypothesized that the world always existed. And from time to time, there were some little vortices that took place and it brought some order out of the chaos. That's just like evolutionary theory today. And things evolved over a finite length of time, but within an infinite universe, long periods of time. So they were evolutionists and they were believed in the eternal nature. And many people thought that if the universe had a beginning, then there had to be a beginner. There had to be a creator to make it. So that's what all the rejection was. And really, in 1965, it all changed because two astronomers working at Bell Labs in New Jersey, working with some studies dealing with microwave transmission of telephone signals, they had a background hiss that they couldn't get rid of. They spent quite a long time trying to find the source of this, never could. And it turned out this hiss was coming from every direction. And this was the what we call the cosmic background radiation, or the cosmic microwave background, CBR, CB, CMB, CBR, same sort of thing. And it was a monumental discovery, because see, in 1948, George Gamow had predicted that the Big Bang would have this. It was a period of time in the past when the universe had a very hot temperature, very high density, and we're seeing the radiation coming from that event, but its light has traveled over billions of light years, and it's been stretched out due to the expansion by about a factor of 1,000. So instead of being 3,000 Kelvin, it's only about 3 Kelvin in temperature. This is a nice plot, I believe, from the COBE mission to look at this. It's a global thing. It's showing you light and dark areas. That was a thing they predicted also in the 70s. That you should see light and dark regions on all of this. Another story I don't have time to talk about tonight much, but they predicted what the fluctuations ought to be in the background, and it turned out the fluctuations were less than they thought that they would be. So they then proudly pronounced that the theory accurately predicted the fluctuations. Say what? The theory predicted the fluctuations, one part in 10,000 in temperature. They did the experiment. They found out fluctuations in one part in 100,000, an order of magnitude lower. And then they proudly proclaimed that the theory had predicted correctly predicted the fluctuations. You heard me right. How did they do that? They altered the model to make it fit the data. They do that a lot with the Big Bang. Now, if I told you at the end of the night there's going to be a quiz, and I told you the answer to the quiz is the only one question, the answer is 42. How would you solve that coming, by the way? Anybody know where the answer comes from? Okay, a few of you do. All right, so a few have been educated here. All right, so the answer is 42. So at the end of the night, I hand out these sheets of paper, and I ask you to put your name on it. It's going to be graded, and you write down, here's the question. I give you the question, and how many of you are going to pass that test? Raise your hand if you think you might pass that test. Hopefully every hand is up. Either A, you don't really care, or B, you are just very disbelieving of anything you hear, or C, you're dumb as a sack of rocks. Take your pick. All right, but that's the reason why you might not pass that test. Well, that's no test of anything, is it? I mean, if you just listen to one thing I said tonight, you'd probably a year from now you still remember that. All right. So that's not a real test of theory, is it? If you give the answers away before you give the test, it hardly is a good test of the model now, is it, or the test of your knowledge of the subject. All right, there was a COBE experiment launched in 1989, as I said, and it was said to look for those predicted fluctuations. The predicted fluctuations were an order of magnitude lower, I just said all this, and the fix was basically to adjust the model to fit the data. And folks, the Big Bang model does that frequently. They say that the light element abundances fit the data, the abundances of hydrogen, helium, their isotopes, and lithium. But what they've done is they've taken the measured abundances and then folded it into the model. Well, no wonder the model correctly predicts you. You've given the answers away already, haven't you? That's no prediction at all. This sort of thing gets passed off as good science all the time. But a couple of modern problems we've had with the Big Bang. By the way, the fluctuations have been detected and confirmed by other experiments, by the way. But 20 years ago, it was a real problem. Okay, there's a horizon problem. It's very interesting. This the Big Bang theory of proof is the background radiation. It's around 3 Kelvin, a little less than 3 Kelvin, with slight fluctuations of one part in 100,000. Here's the interesting thing. If you look off in this direction, call this, look off in a direction, say, 13.5 billion light years away, and I'm getting photons of light in the microwave part of the spectrum, and they have this temperature of 2.73 something, something, something Kelvin. That's point A. And over here, I thought Canadians would like point A over there, all right? And then you look over here, and you see from point B, all this radiation coming from this other point B over here, 13.5 billion years, and it's precisely 2.73 something, something, something temperature. The same temperature you had over there, you have over here. Now let me ask you this question. If the photons of light from point A are just now getting to the Earth, have photons from point A ever been to location B before? No. Have photons from location B ever been to location A? No. For that matter, let's go C and D and E and F, anywhere you want to go. Diametrically opposite points have never actually exchanged photons. Now, there's a principle in thermodynamics that if you have two objects and you bring them together so that they're in thermal contact, they're able to exchange energy either through conduction or radiation or some other method like this, that if you watch what happens and heat flows from one to the other, what do you know? The one has a higher temperature than the other, doesn't it? If it flows the other way, this one has higher temperature. If nothing happens, they have the same temperature. They're in thermodynamic equilibrium with one another. What we see is that point A is in thermodynamic equilibrium with point B. They have the same temperature, yet they've never been in thermal contact. They've never had the opportunity to come to the same temperature, but yet, lo and behold, they are the same temperature. Now, that's amazing when you think about it. It'd be like I have an oven that I can adjust the temperature to one part in 100,000, and you have an oven that you can adjust to one part in 100,000. I turn my oven to the precise temperature without consulting with you. You do likewise. We take a brick. I put a brick in my oven. You put a brick in your oven. Identical bricks. We let them there for an hour. We then rapidly take the two of them out, put them in contact. We find the two bricks have the same temperature to one part in 100,000 Kelvin. Do you believe that's really going to happen? I would deny it. Yet the universe is at this very precise temperature that supposedly proves the Big Bang, but how in the world did it all come to the same temperature? That's a conundrum. And by the 1970s, they realized that was a conundrum. So the distant parts of the universe never been in thermal contact, yet they have that same temperature. There's also the flatness problem. This has to do with geometry and certain types of versions of cosmology. But we can define a Greek letter omega to be the ratio of the gravitational potential energy to the kinetic energy of the universe. Gravitational potential energy refers to your energy you have by virtue of where you are with respect to gravity. A hydroelectric dam is a fantastic example of this. You have water above, behind the dam, and pounded up behind the dam that's higher than water down below. You let the water fall from this higher level through a lower level through the powerhouse. It picks up speed as it does this. That's kinetic energy. It causes the turbines to spin, which then generate electricity. It's just converting that. Things up here have more energy than things down there. The universe has some form of kinetic energy. Excuse me, has some form of gravitational potential energy because it has gravity, because it has matter. But kinetic energy is the energy of motion. Objects that are moving, such as bullets or vehicles, they all have kinetic energy. And things are moving through space. They have, and space itself is moving, they have kinetic energy. And you can make a ratio of those two. Now, what's interesting is that there's a break-even point on the value of omega. It won't stay the same. It will change with time. Because as you expand, you're changing the speed, and you're also changing the gravitational potential energy. But the break-even point is the value of 1. And so if omega starts out a little less than 1, it goes towards 0 pretty quickly. especially after billions of years. And if it starts off greater than one, it increases without bound to very large values. The upshot is that if we sit in the universe here that's supposedly billions of years old, omega should not be anywhere close to one. It should be very, very close to zero or very large values. Yet we've been measuring omega now for the 75 years, and all the values of omega are suspiciously close to one. Somewhere around 1/10 to 1. That's amazing. That meant the universe started off with omega almost exactly equal to 1, like 0.99999999, you know, like 375,000 nines in a row out there, and it's been slowly creeping away. And that seems awful creepy that the universe would start out almost precisely equal to 1. It may be the universe does have omega equal to 1, which would be a very fine-tuning thing if that were the case. So you have these two problems. In one fell swoop back in the 1980s, they decided to solve these two problems by appealing to something called inflation. Now, inflation is this idea that when the universe was very young and very small, maybe the size of a proton, that's one idea that people put forth, theoreticians have tried to explain this thing. The universe pops into existence, maybe it's the size of a proton, which is incredibly small, and overnight, just instantaneously, the universe pops into a much larger size, maybe the size of a grapefruit. Now, a grapefruit doesn't seem very big, but when you compare it to the size of a proton, it's unbelievable, the range in size. And this expansion happened faster than the speed of light. You can do that in general relativity. You can have space itself expand at a very rapid rate. That's why we call it inflation. And the idea is, when the universe pops into existence, it has a certain value for omega. And if you wait long enough, a little tiny fraction of time, then the universe, how small it is, can come in thermal contact and thermal equilibrium with itself. And then this inflation yanks most of the universe out of thermal equilibrium. And it's just starting to regain thermal equilibrium, but it established thermal equilibrium before the inflation took place. And so you get this idea of inflation, and it drives omega almost identically to 1, no matter what its original value is, and you also get the temperature the same everywhere. It's a really slick trick, isn't it? The only problem is there's no evidence for it. Other than the fact somebody, when you ask them for evidence, they may say something like this: well, we're here, aren't we? Now, how many times have you heard that before? In what context was it? You're showing how evolution is, biological evolution doesn't happen. And you shoot down everything that the person's putting forth. And finally, the person gets exasperated and says, well, we're here, aren't we? How many people have had that experience? Okay, if you've been discussing this very much, you've had it. First time I had it was about 30 years ago, and I almost started burst out laughing. I didn't, because it really is funny when you hear it. But it's humiliating, ought to be, for the person, because they don't have any idea of the circularity of reasoning going on with that. And that's what's going on here. You've come up with a good explanation, but is it science? And if there's no evidence that no data support it, that's not really science now, is it? But that's increasingly what it's coming up. We have a Latin word for this, ad hoc, making things up as you go along. Making things up as you go along. And there are all sorts of illustrations you could give for these sorts of things. It reminds me, I think of my neighbor. I go out one day and he's out there and he's chucking orange peels all over the yard. I say, Billy Ray, what are you doing? And Billy Ray says, I'm throwing orange peels in the yard. I said, Billy Ray, I can see that, but why are you throwing orange peels in the yard? He says, keep the elephants away. Billy Ray, there's not an elephant within 50 miles of here, to which Billy Ray says, see, it works. Now, it's hard to argue with that logic, as bad as it is, because he's convinced, right? He's convinced that it works. There's no real evidence, no real prediction, but it works because he knows it works. All right, and this is not terribly different from what evolutionists are throwing at us from time to time, is it? And ultimately, it's not falsifiable. You know, if I come up with with this inflation to try to explain a problem that you have with the model, and you come, you have a problem, so you come up with inflation. And what do you do the next time a problem comes up? Well, you make up something else, some sort of new field, some sort of new force, some sort of new effect, and you can fix that. So everything that comes along, you can always explain, can't you? No matter no matter what happens. Let's take a look at some of the changes in the big model. First of all, the expansion rate changed. You know, for most of my life, at least from 1960, end of the 1990s, they said the expansion rate was 50 kilometers per second per megaparsec. That's the slope of the Hubble constant, that line I showed you earlier from Hubble's original paper. He had a much higher value, but again, remember his data were pretty bad. Mars has gotten better. For more than 30 years, it was 50. But then back in the mid-90s, they said, well, wait a minute, we were wrong. It's now about 80. 75 to 80 kilometers per second per megaparsec. We didn't know what the expansion rate was. But you know what? When you change expansion rate, you also change the age of the universe. Back then, they said the universe is probably 16 to 18 billion years old because of this. Notice the range, 16 to 18. What does that mean? It means anything lower than 16 or more than 18 billion can't be the case, right? But today they say it's 13,710,000,000 and 4 years ago the Big Bang happened. My precision comes from the fact they announced the result 4 years ago, so I have to keep updating it as we go forward here. Now, obviously, that last figure is plus or minus 1%. And we do error bars in physics and astronomy, and you'll notice that one measurement has an error bar and the other has a measurement error bar here, and the two don't close, don't overlap. They both can't be right, can they? They both could be wrong, though, could they not? Okay, what else have they changed? Dark matter, that's something I haven't talked about. This is something that a lot of creationists are really suspicious of. I'm not terribly suspicious of. There's a belief among many creationists that dark matter is somehow created to salvage evolutionary theories. But as it turns out, there is compelling evidence for the existence of dark matter, quite apart from any cosmological models or even evolutionary models for that matter. But once you're convinced that dark matter exists, then you better factor it into your model. Otherwise, your model is missing something. Some estimates of dark matter, something like close to 90% of the universe, is stuff we can't see, and it's stuff we don't even know what it is. It's a form of matter we don't even know about yet. That's humbling to think about that. Think about that. Most of the mass of the universe, we have no idea what it is. As much as we know about physics, we don't know what much of the universe is made out of. So much for physics at that point, right? So you have to factor that in. They've now you put the dark matter in because it's part of what the mass of the universe is. And then there's a thing that Einstein put in his field equations back in 1917. He believed the universe was static. That is, the universe was neither expanding nor was it contracting. Just kind of parked there. Where did he get that idea? From the ancient Greeks. They thought the universe was static too, always existing the way it was. Later on, Lemaitre and Friedman and others showed that the most general form was one where the universe was either expanding or contracting. Later on, Einstein retracted he had a cosmological constant. What it would cause it to do is it would kind of park the universe here, kind of an anti-gravity. Gravities tend to pull the galaxies back together, the universe back together, and this would kind of push them back out again, so they balance. And he said later on that was the biggest blunder he ever made. Or was it? In 1999, everybody was surprised. I was sitting at a meeting of the American Astronomical Society where there was a talk given on this. He put the plots up explaining this, and lo and behold, in 1999, it's back. They've got this cosmological constant repelling space, except now they call it dark energy. They call it dark energy. They kind of dressed it up a little more. They have a little better theoretical formulation with the whole thing, with a field driving it. But it's this thing that they wouldn't have talked about more than 10 or 12 years ago. All right, so I'm going to do a little comparison with the Big Bang model of today to 25 years ago, circa 1985. I was still in grad school at the time, so I was kind of speed at the Big Bang at that time, I think. What'd you have? Well, the expansion rate was different from today. I already mentioned that. You had no inflation. Inflation was just really being developed. They were starting to put it into models. It first was like in 1982, but they shot it down. It was about 1985, 86, where inflation finally arrived. So this was 1985, 25 years ago. It was just the beginning of the inflation model. So I think I can safely say in 1985, most cosmological models didn't include inflation. And you didn't throw in dark matter because people didn't take it very seriously yet. You didn't have dark energy. That was something they threw out in the 20s and didn't reckon back again until 1999. And most astronomers and cosmologists were dragged the whole way screaming on this. I didn't mention string theory, but string theory is this idea dealing with little tiny particles, subatomic particles. The easiest way to say it is one idea we have is that particles, like quarks, behave as if they have additional dimensions, like X, Y, and Z dimensions, and they're like little tiny strings that vibrate. And if we invoke six additional dimensions, a set of X, Y, and Z, and a set of another X, Y, and Z for a total of six dimensions that these things are vibrating on, but yet they're kind of folded up and rolled up and tucked up inside of matter, so they don't really manifest themselves today, you really have about 10 dimensions to the universe. Three spatial dimensions and one time dimension, plus these extra six dimensions. I first heard a guy give a talk on this back in the late 1970s on this, and he was then talking, I think, of 26 or 27 extra dimensions. By the last 10 years, they've pared it down to about six extra dimensions. That's the minimum. They're making more than that. This is a serious idea they're pursuing in particle theories today, and some of the stuff they're trying to do at CERN there, and the big particle accelerator in Europe, is trying to confirm some of the aspects of this model. There's no real evidence for it yet, by the way. But they're convinced this may be the best model to explain what's going on with matter. Well, so what? Well, in the universe, in the Big Bang, when it starts, it's so hot and so dense, those extra dimensions start playing themselves out. They're manifest and they're important. You have to factor those in. Today, you put a string theory in, 25 years ago, you wouldn't have, because the model really had not been developed too much. Would you agree the two models are pretty different from 25 years ago and today? They're almost unrecognizable. But I'll tell you, there's something in common. 25 years ago, the cosmologist had complete confidence in the theory. And today, they have complete confidence in the theory. I'm really struck with the fact just how different the model of today and back then are from one another. Now, I'm not sure what the model is going to look like in another 25 years, but I am confident in one thing. It will be two things. They'll be very different from today's model, and they'll have 100% confidence in that model. All right? So, doesn't this start to look like epicycles to you? That's why I start off with epicycles. Remember, the Ptolemaic model worked only because you kept bringing in baling wire, chewing gum, and duct tape, didn't you? And you kept making alterations and changes and changes and changes. And finally, after 15 centuries, people said, this is nuts. And they gave it up for something simpler. And I'm concerned with the Big Bang model by virtue of the fact it's the only game in town and it's the only model that people will allow. I think that's not the way science is supposed to work. And you're supposed to actually try to falsify it there. This can't be. You have rules that allow you to keep adjusting the model until you can do it ever and ever and ever. How does this compare with Scripture? Does Scripture change? No, thankfully, that's one thing we can count on. God doesn't change, and Scripture doesn't change. Which one would you rather put your faith in and your reliance upon? Something that changes from day to day or year to year, or something that never changes? I think that's a no-brainer, wouldn't you? What's the creationary history of the world? Well, on day one, heaven and the earth and light were created. Pretty sparse information there, but that's what it tells us. Day two, it has separation of water above and below with that rakia in between. What is that? I have no idea. I have different ideas, but it's really a kind of a slippery idea, I think. Day three, you have dry land and plants. You know, a few years ago, I heard about this group. You've probably heard of this musical group called Third Day. If I had a band, what would the name of it be? The fourth day, right? That's my favorite day. That's the day the sun, moon, and the stars were made, right? So I could go one up on third day, fourth day. We would be singing about stars and stuff like that. I'm really frustrated, though, because I study stellar astronomy. That makes me a stellar astronomer, you see. And when it does the creation account, it says he made the sun and the moon. And then in the Hebrew, what it literally says at the end, it simply says the stars also. And in the King James and other translations, in the English, they say, he made the stars also. But literally, the Hebrew says the stars also. Almost like an afterthought. Oh, by the way, I made stars too. That's very frustrating for me because I love stars, and the Lord didn't really give us a lot of information about this. It gives me a lot of latitude, perhaps, but still, we're restricted to day four, as far as I'm concerned. Aquatic and flying life on day five, back to the earth now, back to day six, land animals and humans, and of course, on the seventh day, God rested. So the question is, the Big Bang, is it biblical? Well, let's see. The event happened 13.71 billion years ago, right? And 4 years, I guess. What does the Bible say? Well, the Bible doesn't clearly tell us when the creation was, but it does tell us it was 6 days long and it finished at the end of 6 days. And if you look at the genealogies in the Old Testament, you get something around a few thousand years. I like 6,000. I really don't like 10,000. I think 6,000, maybe 7, is a good figure there. Very different for 13.7 billion years. Exodus 20:11 says, "For in 6 days God made the heavens and earth and all that are in them." That's a reaffirmation from another passage. But in the evolutionary model, Big Bang model, from there you come down to the development of stars and so forth. Many stars preceded the Earth because you see the Sun and the Earth and the rest of the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago, according to the evolutionary models. There were 9 billion years of stars evolving before this Earth came along. So there had to be many countless stars before the Earth came along. But Genesis 1 through 14 through 19 tells us that the Earth came first on day one and the stars came on day four. Also, it's an ongoing process. But, you know, the Bible says that the creation was finished there in Genesis 2, verses 1 and 3. It tells us that he rested on the seventh day. It's a completed project. And anyway, where are you going to place the time? People try putting it in the gap. They try putting it in day age. They try putting it in all sorts of places. And you know, I've gone on record many times. I tell people, and I'm serious about this, I'm intellectually open to billions of years. But it's got to be done in a biblically faithful fashion. And I think I've seen every way people have tried, and they all come wanting, very short on this. They're really doing disservice to Scripture by trying to reinterpret these things. So they have allegory, all sorts of things, and I haven't seen a way yet that makes any sense biblically. You have a low view of Scripture, I believe, if you start taking that sort of approach. Problems of the Big Bang in the Bible. The direction of the research is atheistic. Some people claim that there are all these cosmologists and astronomers being brought to Christ because they find the Big Bang brings them back to a beginning, a beginner, like LeMaitre was trying to do. The only problem with that is you look at all the really big heavy hitters in the field, and they're all atheists and agnostics. Steven Weinberg wrote a book back in the 70s called The First 3 Minutes. Some of you may have read that book. I think the epilogue is very chilling. The last two paragraphs of the book are very depressing. This man's an agnostic, as far as I know. And he concludes the book by saying, observing that the more he studies the world, the more he comes to the conclusion that it's pointless. It's just pointless. And he finally concludes the book by the next paragraph by saying this attempt to find out about the structure and origin of the world is the one of the few things that lifts our existence above the level of farce. That's sad. That's truly sad that he's honest in that assessment, though, because if you don't, without the Lord, that is exactly where you find yourself. The time issue I've already mentioned is a real problem. Order of creation is all wrong. I could go into a lot of detail about that. Other people more eloquent than I am have already done this, about how things are out of order from what science would have us believe was the order of things. I already mentioned stars being just one of them. And, you know, here's something very interesting. The beginning and the end of the universe are going to be sudden. You know, there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth because the old heaven and the old earth are going to pass away. We also read that the heavens will be rolled up like a scroll. Those things get unrolled if you let them go. And I think that's interesting because Old Testament passages talk about the heavens being stretched out like a curtain or like a tent. Middle Eastern tents, they would kind of roll these things up and kind of unroll them like this to open them up. So I'm thinking the universe begins suddenly with the world, Lord stretching out or spreading out or rolling out that thing like a tent, and he's going to end it abruptly by rolling it up like a scroll and closing it up once again. If the universe ends suddenly and dramatically, even catastrophically, then why would we not expect the beginning of the universe to also be like that? And so the beginning and the end of the universe are very sudden, as 2 Peter 3:10 talks about. And the big question here, when the Big Bang Theory is abandoned, and this is important, if you've wedded your apologetic to the Big Bang Theory, what happens when the Big Bang Theory is rejected? And it will be. I'm convinced of it eventually. It took 15 centuries for the Ptolemaic model. I hope it won't take that long for this turkey. But the thing is, it will be rejected if the history of science tells us anything. And if you've lashed yourself and you're apologetic to the mass of that ship, when it goes down, it takes your apologetic with it. And it discredits the Lord and the Bible when it does. So the apologetic is wrong. It's changing. Big Bang is changing. I've already demonstrated tonight. Our apologetic ought not to change, because if it's relying upon Scripture. I think it's contrary to Scripture on many points. And so when it's discarded, what happens to our apologetic here? This is one of the most remarkable pictures ever taken. It's the Hubble Deep Field North, taken now almost 15 years ago. And it's a little tiny insignificant spot in the sky where they trained the HST for many hours and took this exposure. And in this little photograph, you have something like 1,700 individual galaxies. Virtually everything you see there in that photograph is a little tiny galaxy. Truly remarkable. These things are so far away and so little light coming from them, we can't even get the spectrum to analyze these things. And it truly tells me that we have an immense and unbelievably, a mind-blowingly large universe. And yet we have a creator who has all this power and majesty to do this, yet he cares about you and me and all of that. You know, the psalmist in 8 wrote that question, when you consider the sun, the moon, and the stars, and the heavens above, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And it says he's made us, made a man just a little lower than the angel, and crowned him with glory and with honor. And that's really interesting that he's done that for us. I'd like to close tonight very briefly, giving a very brief presentation of the gospel. I trust everyone here is born again, but just in case there may be someone here, I want to share very quickly with you a few elements of the gospel. The fact that God made us. I think to me that's abundantly clear that we have a creator. Apart from the Bible, I find it inconceivable that I just happened and you just happened, the world around us happened. That scientifically makes no sense at all to me. But we also told from Scripture that sin separates us from God. Man and woman have disobeyed God in the Garden of Eden, and it caused sin to enter the world, and we've inherited that sinful nature through Adam. But thankfully, Jesus was sent into the world as God's Son, as the last Adam to die on the cross, live a perfect life, of course, and God with us, and then die a perfect sacrifice for us. But then he didn't stop there. He rose from the dead on the third day. And we have salvation through faith, simple faith, through the redeeming work of the Lord Jesus Christ.